Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Welcome to our anniversary celebration. This is either the 42nd or the 43rd anniversary of Ananda, depending on how we count. We had two 40th anniversaries, which was pleasant. The reason for that, lest it seem totally ignorant, is that we started with the meditation retreat, and that was really going a year ahead of when we got the property here. And so, depending on how you want to look at it, we're choosing to consider, because the signing of the lease and the ability to come onto this property took place on July 4th, 1969. It seems such an appropriate time to celebrate our anniversary that we're considering that really the anniversary of Ananda Community, the Communities Movement, and the year before is the anniversary of the roots of Ananda. So anyway, we will talk about July 4th and anniversaries and a variety of things today. What Devi and I want to talk about is Yogananda's vision for cooperative communities. But that vision didn't come out of nothing. It wasn't as if there was no predecessor to that. In fact, there are kind of long, long rhythms to it that I'll touch on in a little while. But communities in and of themselves are not all that important or novel. There have been communities for as long as people were together. And, you know, there were communities of, I mean, you look back at a linear history, which isn't really true, but if you do it that way, there were communities of cave people. And they lived in one cave, and cave number 7 was against cave number 9, you know. And so there were groups of people living in communities. It's just an absolutely natural way to live. And there are a large variety of reasons that people gather together in communities. We don't really need to go into it. It's enough to say that's just the way we're made, is to live in community. The question then is not whether communities are right or valid. They're just be like asking whether breathing is right or valid. It's just natural. The question then is what kind of community we should live in. And that becomes a very, very significant and very important question. So when we begin to ask the questions why community, why should we live in them, then we have to go back, why are we alive anyway? Why are we on the planet? What is the purpose of life? And the purpose of life, if we don't ask that fundamental question, then everything else seems random. Everything else, whether you live in this community or that community, whether it's organized along these government principles or that government principle, all of that just seems like it's random. Like, you know, take your choice, everyone's equal, all systems are equal, why not do it the way you want to do it? And in fact, that is a very, very strong mindset in the world today. My opinion is just as valid as your opinion. There's no real purpose to life, so let's do what we want to do. And then with that paradigm, you get all sorts of little subgroups that are kind of shouting, working for the mind space, the mindscape of humanity. You know, buy me, eat me, take me home, as one of our members said, driving along the freeway, looking at the billboards, that's what was shouted at him. Buy me, eat me, take me home. And so, why isn't that paradigm the right paradigm? I mean, we laugh at it, but the people who are trying to sell us the stuff, they aren't laughing at it. They believe in that paradigm. So unless we ask the fundamental question, what is the purpose for life, we get nowhere. So what is the purpose of life? Well, the purpose of life is self-realization. As we put it in the festival all the time, every Sunday, from the forming of, I'm going to read it, the forming of stars and moons and planets, of galaxies revolving on the tides of space, of drifting continents, upheaving mountains, snowy wastes and dark, silent ocean deeps, had but this for its design. So the whole process of the universe, the forming of the universe, and the coming together of separate atoms into planets and galaxies had a design behind it. And what is the design? The birth of life. And with life's birth, the dawn of self-awareness, passage through dim corridors of waking consciousness to emerge at last into infinite light, into perfect joy. And so the whole cosmic drama is there in order to produce life, and life as it evolves to produce self-awareness, and as self-awareness evolves to produce perfect joy and everlasting happiness. Why? Because that's the element, the consciousness from which we came. We came from perfect joy. We came from self-awareness. We came from existence. Life cannot spring up of itself. It has to come from life. And so that life, that existence, that consciousness, that exploration of consciousness, the evolution of self-awareness, and finally, the goal of life reaching out to perfect joy or bliss, Satchitananda, as it's put in the great scriptures of India. The definition of God, self, is Satchitananda. And so the purpose of life, the whole evolutionary process that we look at, is moving toward a purpose, a goal, and that goal is the achievement of the consciousness of Satchitananda, or of self-realization. Master defines self-realization as the knowing in all parts of body, mind, and soul that you are now in possession of the kingdom of God. The kingdom of God is that Satchitananda, that awareness, that you need not pray for it to come to you, that God's omnipresence is your omnipresence, and all you have to do is improve your knowing. So that's how Master defined self-realization. And that's the state that we're trying to get to. Not only we, but everyone is trying to get to that state. That's the whole drama of life. From one might say, unawareness, or lack of self-awareness, growing and improving consciousness until we achieve that final state of union with God. Now, if we have that understanding as the purpose of life, then we can evaluate everything. We can evaluate eat me, buy me, take me home. We can evaluate communities. We can see, are they good, are they bad? Because everything can be judged by whether it moves us toward that goal or whether it moves us away from that goal. Swami, I loved his definition of good karma. Somebody once asked him, what is good karma? And, you know, the typical idea of good karma is, well, you win the lottery, or, you know, you marry the prince and you become the queen. Whatever it is, I remember years and years ago we went to the Renaissance fair, and it was kind of hot and dusty. I think it was in September in Marin County, and they had big kind of fire truck that went around and sprayed the roads with water to keep the dust down. And on the side, the truck was called Good Karma. And so we tend to think that good karma is that which we like, and bad karma is that which we don't like. That's a very dangerous definition of good karma. That's the definition that's got us in the mess that we're in and gotten us to think eat me, buy me, take me home is in fact the goal of life. Swami said, good karma is that which moves you closer to God, and bad karma is that which moves you away. And so a broken leg, Sudarshan, probably is good karma if it moves you closer to God. But the world isn't, by and large, ready for that definition yet, nor is it ready for understanding the true purpose. And that is why Ananda, as a community, master, and these teachings are so important, so vital for the world, because it doesn't take very much. All it takes to improve the quality of life for the whole planet, well, for one, all it would really take is for the planet to understand that the purpose of life is growing consciousness and moving toward perfect joy and infinite light. If the whole world understood that, the whole world would be a very, very different place than what it is now. But we're in the early years of that understanding. But that's also why communities are so very important and very vital. So understanding that this direction toward self-realization and towards Satchitananda is the purpose of life, then we can then ask the question, what is going to help us move toward that, and what is going to retard our movement toward that? And so as you take that Satchitananda and you begin to translate it down from its high, high, subtle understandings, kind of translate it down into evolutionary terms, you know, a worm is not ready to understand the concepts of self-realization. So what is it able to understand of that? It's able to understand that it has some... Well, let's move up the evolutionary scale. Worms are so dim that, you know, it's hard to make the analogy. Let's take a wolf. Because it's, you know, it's fairly well along, but it's previous to a human birth. So let's take a wolf. What is a wolf's understanding of Satchitananda? It has one. All of life, all of the universe, if it's made from that, it has some increasingly clear understanding of what that is. So what is a wolf's understanding? Sat, existence. One of the fundamental aspects of animal life is that animals seek to continue their existence. The hunt for food, the hunt for shelter, the reproductive process to carry on the genetic aspect, all of that, all of those things are an attempt to continue existence. Now, we know, the wolf doesn't, that, or presumably the wolf doesn't have a clear understanding, but we know that the physical body is temporary. We know that death awaits all of us at the end of it. We know that the keeping alive of the physical body is not the end all and be all, nor is it what's going to produce the other two. So what are the other two? Chit is the expansion of self-awareness. And so the wolf, by its nature, is very curious. Its senses are very active. Some of them, its hearing and smell, are much more powerful than ours. And so the wolf in a sensory world is more aware, one might say, than we are. And so being aware isn't quite what it is it? But that's why Swami in the festival didn't say growing awareness, growing self-awareness. And the wolf probably does not have self-awareness as I am something separate. It's just kind of together. In fact, there are some interesting, I like little psychological studies. My background, my major was psychology. So when I come across them, I read these little studies. And so there are studies trying to see if an animal has self-awareness. So a wolf, when it sees an image of another wolf in a mirror, will growl at that image because it thinks that that image is a separate entity from itself. But as you move up the scale, a baboon, I don't know a baboon, but a chimpanzee seeing its image in a mirror knows that that image in the mirror is a reflection of itself. How do they know that? It's an interesting little experiment. They put a little mark on the fur, and a chimpanzee looking in the mirror will try to wipe that mark away from his own forehead, not wipe it away from the mirror. So that shows that there's a growing self-awareness. And as we move up through the evolutionary scale, one could say that the way to really judge the evolutionary scale is by the degree, not of awareness, but of self-awareness. And that is a good definition, because otherwise, Swami has said, you know, his father, who is a scientist, kind of said when Swami was 6 or 7 years old, you know, man, the dinosaurs used to rule the earth, and now man rules the earth, and someday it will be the bird's turn to rule the earth. And Swami kind of thought, 6 years old, he said, that can't be right. Can't be right, because it isn't random. It's increasing self-awareness is what gives us the evolution. Okay, so now, we've got the existence part, we've got the awareness part, and then what about the Ananda part? Well, the wolf or the chimpanzee or most people aren't yet ready to understand that bliss, eternal, ever new joy, is what they're after. But that translated down is happiness. Master said everybody in the world is motivated by the twin desire to avoid pain and to achieve happiness. And so you take happiness and you begin to follow the breadcrumbs of happiness up the scale. The wolf, what's happiness for the wolf? Well, wolves are social animals. They have a hierarchy. And so probably one form of happiness for wolves are to move up in the power hierarchy toward the alpha wolf. Doesn't sound very much different than Wall Street bankers to me. So that sense that social status or power in society, that confers happiness, is just, the wolf probably doesn't ever cognize, forgive me, wolf goddess or whoever's up there, because I may be totally wrong about awareness of wolves. I'm just speculating, but it's symbolic. So that is the paradigm that we're working toward. So the existence and the ability to have the freedom to struggle to gain self-awareness and the desire to be happy and move toward bliss, those are the driving forces of the purpose of humanity, which brings us to the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence says, where is it? Here it is. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's pretty good Satchitananda definition. We hold these truths to be self-evident. They were all but self-evident at the time that those words were written. In fact, politically, really the Declaration of Independence was not so much a declaration of independence from England as a declaration of independence from Kali Yuga thinking. And that's what makes that such a powerful, powerful time in history and spiritually. Because, first of all, why America? Why is America the place where new freedoms, new forms of government, new ideas could take place and take root and grow? Basically, there wasn't any competition. A new idea in England was snuffed out by the king and the dukes and the royalty and the hierarchy, and so rebellion couldn't easily take place, or new ideas, the formation of new ideas, couldn't easily take place in an already existing society that had the tendency, all societies have the tendency of self-perpetuation, just like the wolf does. Society has that same tendency. And so the self-perpetuation of a powerful group of people would not allow new ideas to take root. And so Dwapara Yuga had to move across the ocean, get a 3,500-mile separation from that thought form and form in a new place. And even here, even coming here, didn't confer these new ideas very easily. The early Americans thought of themselves not as Americans. They thought of themselves as British, as English. And it was a big, big turmoil to break that thought form in order to achieve independence. And that's why the Declaration of Independence didn't spring up overnight. It took 2 years of turmoil and meeting and discussion and all kinds of energy with great, great people. These founding fathers were born for this purpose. I'm convinced that they were great spiritual beings, yogis from the past, that incarnated in order to do this job. It had a very important message to it. And so they came together, and even they had to work and try to break free of the incrustations of the consciousness of hierarchy that belongs to Kali Yuga, that the king and the royalties and the peers, they had the absolute right to make decisions and impose that will on others. And gradually, slowly, in other parts of the world, that was breaking down. It's not that that was never was. Master said that was the consciousness of ancient India. So it wasn't like it was a new idea. It was that that idea had been submerged during Kali Yuga. And now was its time had come to reemerge. And so that reemergence of the new Dwapara Yuga form of government, where all we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. As I said, that was anything but self-evident at that time. And it wasn't even self-evident to those who were saying that it was self-evident. Thomas Jefferson, who wrote those words, was a slave owner. When the vote came, women didn't have the vote. All men might have been created equal. But even John Adams, his wife, told him, "Remember the ladies. When you form your new government, remember the ladies, because if you do not remember them, your government will not be able to stand." And so we were breaking out of those old thought forms of equality. Now, here's a question. Are all men created equal? I don't think so. Not in the way that they were talking about it. All souls are created equal, but there are definitely gradations in the consciousness. It's a tricky question. See, having equal rights is different from being equal in consciousness. And there are certainly gradations in, if we go back to that kind of pole star that we're following, of the purpose of life is increasing self-awareness, then are all men born with equal degrees of self-awareness? Are all men and women born with equal degrees of self-awareness? No, I don't think so. Are they born with the equal potential for self-awareness? Absolutely. And therefore, you must, when you form a society, you must allow the freedom to pursue in whatever manner they feel is right. You must allow the liberty to pursue their own goals and their own growth in self-awareness. So when Jefferson wrote life, liberty is extremely important in that, and the pursuit of happiness, eventually leading toward bliss. Now, what about the pursuit of happiness? I've touched on the other two. The pursuit of happiness is best understood not by generally when we think of happiness and define happiness, what we're defining is what fits with my likes and dislikes, my own preconceived, preconditioned pattern. What fits with that? If it fits with that, it makes me happy. If it doesn't, it makes me unhappy. So one kind of food to one person will make him happy, for another person will make him unhappy. Davy was just reading this book, Mao's Last Dancer, about a wonderful book and a wonderful movie, I would recommend it, about a dancer who defected from China and became a very famous dancer, came here in the 1960s. But he went out on his 80. He went out on his very first date, and it was with a woman. He didn't speak, well, obviously, okay. He didn't speak very good English, and so they were having a little trouble communicating. He figured, what I want to do is really impress this lady. I'll take her to a Chinese restaurant, and I will order something very special, and that will really, really make her happy. And so he ordered
pig's intestines and sea slugs.
Pig's intestines and sea slugs. Now, what could lead to greater happiness than that? We hold these truths to be self-evident. Pig's intestines and sea slugs lead to happiness. And so one person's happiness is not the same as another's. And so that question of how to achieve happiness is not as simple as it sounds, because just the achievement of happiness doesn't last very long. And so what is the evolutionary process of achieving happiness? Well, you might define it by that which is lasting happiness is real happiness and leads toward the goal of bliss. And that which is temporary is not happiness that leads toward bliss and may in fact lead away from the achievement of bliss. I don't know about pig's intestines and sea slugs in that paradigm, but let's assume that even at best it confers only temporary happiness and only to that segment of people who accept, have predefined, been preconditioned to accept that that leads to happiness. And so you see over and over and over, the whole, if you could stand back and just kind of gaze like you're sitting at a Paris sidewalk cafe and watching the people walk by, you're sitting and just watching humanity stream by, and you see all of this enormous energy and effort going to achieve goals that are very, very temporary in conferring and keeping the state of happiness. I hate to break it to you, but even the iPhone 4 is only going to give you temporary happiness. And tweeting is not going to do much more for you. So this pursuit, but it's a basically almost mindless pursuit, isn't it? Where if it's different, if it's new, if it's somehow accepted by others, then it's the way to happiness. Well, gradually you begin to, with enough experience, enough seeing that paradigm of trying to catch happiness, getting it, and then it kind of turning to sand in your hands and falling through your fingers, and you pursue the next goal, and you do that over and over and over again. What happens? It finally takes on, as Master said, an anguishing sense of monotony. An anguishing sense of monotony. And there we're beginning to get to the spiritual path. Because when the things of this world, see, worldly consciousness, you know, we talk about all of worldly consciousness, that's so awful, terrible, bad thing to be, bad thing to have. All it is really is the thought that things outside yourself are going to confer happiness to you. Worldly things confer happiness. That paradigm that is accepted by the great, great mass of mankind on the planet today is not a very valid paradigm. And so the pursuit of happiness is absolutely necessary, but the way that we're pursuing it is not very sophisticated yet. And that now brings this whole life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that evolution of that brings us to the spiritual path. Because gradually we begin to understand that the pursuit of happiness, the expansion of self-awareness, and that life itself is an interior, not an exterior process, is something of consciousness, not of senses, is inside yourself, not in the world. And that now brings us to Master's spiritual path and to the achievement of true happiness and the reason for communities. So what Master and the other great masters have said is that your happiness does not lie outside of yourself. Your happiness lies inside. I mean, it's so common sense to us who've been working with these principles for 42 years, Ananda's anniversary, or however long, that happiness lies within, not without, that it just seems, well, it's so obvious. But it's not obvious in the world. It's far from obvious. Those truths are not self-evident in the world. And in order to show that true happiness lies within, we need to be part of that process. So Master came. His mission was to come and to help people begin to see that, that happiness lies within. Now, as part of that, he brought the ancient spiritual path back to us, because if increasing self-awareness and finding the world of fulfillment within is the real way, how do we go about that? I saw a lecture by somebody a while back, and he basically had the spiritual principles, but he didn't give any path to it. He basically said, all you have to do is stop thinking that everything else will give you happiness and you're already arrived. Well, theoretically, that's true. You do arrive as soon as you think that. But why don't we all think it? Why isn't everybody on the planet self-realized if it's that simple? There's this big momentum of our own past, our own decisions, our own tendencies, our own samskaras that hold us in. And there's mass delusion that is telling us to eat me, buy me, take me home. And that's the way to happiness. And so Master comes with a radically different paradigm for us. And that paradigm is that you find happiness within, and you find happiness, one, by detaching yourself from the outgoing energy and from the sense of fulfillment through the senses. You detach even from the senses themselves, and you pull that energy back within. So if you can pull your life force back, and if you can detach from the senses, then you begin to discover the inner world, and that inner world is where your ultimate fulfillment arises. Now, Master didn't invent this or initiate it. It goes way back. It's ancient teachings. It's Patanjali's fifth and sixth step of the Eightfold Path. The pranayama and pratyahara is the withdrawal of energy and the withdrawal of energy from the senses. And when that can take place, then we're able to begin to perceive true meditation, which is the realm of consciousness within, ultimately to lead us to the point where our consciousness first withdraws and then expands, and expands so completely that we break down the self-definition that I am this body and mind and personality, and we become united. Our real, honest-to-goodness self-definition, not just theoretical, but self-definition, is that I am everything that exists, and ultimately that I am the consciousness, the Satchitananda, that brings out all of existence from itself. And that's self-realization. We're in possession of the kingdom of God. So Master brings a spiritual path, which is meditation and service, is how he described his spiritual path. And he brings specific techniques, brings a huge body of teachings on not just techniques, but the attitudes that lead toward the fulfillment of those techniques. And he brings that as a gift to the world. And many people are picking up on the desire to do that. But it's not easy, because mass consciousness isn't there yet. Mass consciousness, most of us, probably many of you, when you became serious about the spiritual path and told your friends or your parents or your siblings that you were really serious about the spiritual path, so serious that you were going to move to a community where that was the prime purpose, they thought you were nuts. Some people in this community have had their parents kidnap them and try to deprogram them, because they had the idea that they wanted to pursue happiness interiorly, not exteriorly. And so that paradigm is not there very strongly in mass consciousness. And because Master said environment is stronger than willpower, environment is stronger, that mass consciousness is very powerful. And unless you're very, very aware, very, very evolved, you can't stand up against it alone. Why can't you? I was thinking about this. Where's the point at which you can stand up to mass consciousness It's when you're no longer reactive, when you have learned to control the reactive process in the self. Go within, detach yourself, control the reactive process, practice the teachings. That was Maria's legacy to us. So control the reactive process. When you can do that, you can live anywhere. Because mass consciousness doesn't bring up the reactive process in you. Somebody gets angry at you, you don't fall into anger. Somebody says, ooh, you'll be really, really happy if you get the iPhone 4. You don't have the reactive process that says, I'll be really, really happy if I get the iPhone 4. You might still get it because it's a good tool, but it won't be out of desire. See, and that's Patanjali. When we neutralize the waves of likes and dislikes, we automatically achieve the state of union with God. And so that's what we're after, but it's not easy to do unless we've already gotten a strong, strong degree of evolution already. And so, because environment is stronger than willpower, Master said, those of you who want to seek God, gather together. Form communities. Form world brotherhood colonies for high thinking and simple living. Because that group reinforcement, it's much, much easier to practice meditation and service in the magnetism and thought form of a community than it is out on our own. And it's much easier. There are a couple of reasons. One is that the mass consciousness of communities like Ananda help move us toward that direction of self-realization. But they also have a kind of stultifying effect on movement the other direction. You know, so if you begin to slip into, oh, if I amass more and more money, more and more possessions, more and more whatever, you hear every week the thought that what else is wisdom if not to keep what is mine for myself? The stage of rebellion. Oh gosh, that's right, that is. That's the stage of rebellion. It isn't true wisdom. And you hear that reinforce it, the tendency to slip downward in the scale of your own understanding, not something exterior, your own understanding to slip downward is retarded, and the upward path is kind of oiled for you because people have tread that upward path before you and they leave little goodies for you all along the way. They leave their own joy. They leave their own calmness and wisdom. Swami moves along that path and he gives a model, and those are, as we say, treasures along the path. He leaves, those are his lectures, treasures along the path. He's moved in that upward path. He's left all these little treasures along the way. And so instead of thinking, eat me, buy me, take me home, we think, gosh, maybe I'll listen to that lecture on Patanjali. Maybe I'll study the Gita. Maybe I'll listen to one of his, what is now probably 385 talks on the Bhagavad Gita. Maybe I'll read spiritual literature. So those treasures along the path, the way to enlightenment has been oiled for us, and the living in community together produces a mindset and a thought form that makes that process our own self-chosen path. It makes it easier for us. And that is why Ananda is important, not because it's a community, but because it is a way of life that will lead toward greater self-awareness and greater liberty and greater pursuit of happiness toward bliss. And that's why it's important that we come together in communities and that we celebrate the coming together in communities on a day like this, which is our 42nd anniversary, and that we help however we can in the world to spread this paradigm, not because it helps us necessarily, even though it does, but because it is a great, great gift to the world, a gift that we have been given and that we can pass on. And it's a blessing to be involved in this life and a blessing to be a part, not only for our own self-growth, but because it is a life well lived.
To quote P.G. Woodhouse, some good talk. So, you know, Swamiji wrote about a year ago this book, The Time Tunnel, and it should be coming out later this year. And in this book, the two little boys, Bobby and Donnie, who are Swami and his younger brother, travel through time, back and forth. And I thought for what we'll be doing for the rest of our time together this morning is to do a little time travel. And so Jyotish talked about, he read the inspiring passage from the Declaration of Independence, and that was written in 1775. Is that correct? 76, okay. And so that was a benchmark. This new vision came out. But now let's move a little farther ahead in time. Let's move 90 years after the Declaration of Independence, and we find America once again engaged in a tremendous battle on this soil. And this is the Civil War. And someone said that the Civil War was actually the last battle of the battle for independence. Because until the idea that slavery was really flew in the face of the Declaration of Independence and the principles for which this country was founded, we hadn't really won our independence. We hadn't created a free country. And if we know some of the history of the Civil War, tremendous loss of lives, tremendous dedication. And then in 1863, the President of the United States at that time, Abraham Lincoln, wrote on the back of an envelope a little address, a speech he was going to give that took but a few minutes. And he said, 47 years ago, almost 90 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal, just echoing the Declaration of Independence. But then he concludes that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from this earth. And so sometimes we can look at history as separate little events. That's how we're taught in school, not in Education for Life schools, but in traditional education. Just a lot of little separate events. But it's so helpful to start taking the thread of consciousness and weaving them together, as Jyotish was talking, of the evolution of consciousness. So there's the Declaration of Independence, the reaffirmation, and once again, the tremendous sacrifice of life to reinforce those principles 90 years later, so 1863. Now, 30 years after that, what happened? 1893? Does that ring a bell? A little Indian boy was born. His name was Mukunda Lal Ghosh, just born of a family of wealthy Kshatriya family. His mother, who was a wonderful devotee, took him to her guru, Lahiri Mahashaya, and he said, your son will be a spiritual engine who will bring many souls to God. These events are woven together, not random. And he was the usher in, he was born right in that transition between the shifting of ages, Kali Yuga and Dwapara, because as Swamiji has told us, he is the avatar, the guiding spiritual teacher, the transforming consciousness of Dwapara Yuga. And so he came at that time. And he grew up in India. He lived during the First World War. And he felt that suffering. You read in that one chapter in Autobiography of a Yogi how the Law of Miracles, how he was sitting in his bed one day meditating, and all of a sudden he felt his consciousness transported to a captain of a battleship engaged in a naval battle during World War I. And he felt this big shell hit his ship, and the ship started to sink, and then a bullet pierced his chest, and he felt the life going out of his body, and he thought, I'm dying. And then he returned, there he was sitting on his bed at Forgarpur Road, and he was so confused. And then once again he was transported back to the body of that dying captain, and he said, am I alive or am I dead? And he heard a divine voice of God saying, what has life or death to do with light? You are light, and that is the substance of which you are made. And so that suffering of World War II, he understood that this play of light and shadows, I must teach people that in this world of suffering, that is not who they are. And in 1920, he took the first ship leaving India and the city of Sparta. Again, Sparta, city of Sparta, great city of warriors. And he took that ship as a spiritual warrior to come to this country. And he began his remarkable mission. And then he lived through World War II. And he described in autobiography in that chapter at the very end where he said he got a letter from one of his, during the war years, now it's the Second World War, lived through the Depression, lived on tomatoes, coming to the Second World War. And he said he got a letter from his devotees in London who said, even during the bombing of London, we would meet, have our weekly meetings, and we would practice Kriya Yoga. So that seed of Kriya Yoga was already beginning to take root in this world that was still very much lost in darkness. And then 1945, the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Anandi and Bharat were just there and told us beautiful and inspiring stories of the transformative power. We in America think of the destruction, but the lives that were transformed, and how from that holocaust of the atomic bomb, the deep, whereas before their schooling and their government was saying the highest thing to do is to be a warrior and be a kamikaze mission and so forth. But after that, this great movement for peace began emerging in Hiroshima and in Japan. So 1945, what happens in 1946? Master publishes Autobiography of a Yogi. And in fact, many of us who were the first generation of Ananda residents were born in that year as well, or configured around that time. Then we move forward a little bit in time, 1948. A young man in New York reads Autobiography of a Yogi, takes the first bus he can across the country. Of course, that's Swami Kriyananda. And then 1949, 4 years only after the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima, weave the threads together. It's not very long. Master is at a garden party in Beverly Hills. That's only 4 years after that. And he gives the speech that Swami talks about over and over, which really was the birth of Ananda. I mean, really, that's our original birthday, was that Beverly Hills talk. And he talked about communities, and he talked about the need for them. He had experienced in his own consciousness the suffering of that first 50 years of this planet, of this yuga. and the First World War, the depression caused by greed and competition and selfishness, the Second World War caused by an extension of that desire for power. And then Master says, world brotherhood colonies are the answer to the suffering of these times. And in his the last edition of Autobiography, not the first one, the last one published in 1952 before he died, he left the body. He said one of the missions of the work he started was to spread a spirit of brotherhood among all people and to aid in establishing in many countries self-sustaining world brotherhood colonies for plain living and high thinking. And he said these would uplift civilization. Moving into the future, he said this would be the social pattern of the new age. He said it would spread like wildfire. We haven't seen this yet. This is into the future where we haven't yet arrived. But he also, he gave some practical instructions about how to do communities, and they're so charming. He said, band together. This is a quote from Swamiji telling us what Master said. Band together, he would cry, those of you who can do so in spiritual communities where you can grow your own food, said Ananta. Produce your own vegetables and eggs, Peter. And if possible, have your own fresh milk. So Varani and the boys who are buying the cows, you know, man, it's so specific, so specific. And he said, live simply close to God and with other people who love God. And that's all of us doing that. Such communities, he said, would serve as a model for the new age when countless similar self-sustaining communities will popularize voluntary cooperation over competition as the true key to lasting prosperity and inner fulfillment. So Master showed us how to do this, and it's woven over a thread of time. And as Jyotish was saying, his essential teachings were happiness is within you. And the symbol, the logo, the image that Swami created, what is the name of it? Joy is within you. And I really encourage you, every time you drive in our driveway, you know, you're out there, you've been on a trip, you've been shopping, you went to the movie, you went out to dinner, whatever it is, and you're a little bit in the consciousness of eat me, buy me, take me home, this is what makes me happy. You drive in, and there's that beautiful gold logo, and it's saying, joy is within you, as soon as you drive onto Ananda's property. So I challenge myself and all of us, every time you drive past that, don't just say, oh, look, they planted some new plants there. Oh, gosh, the deer, that was supposed to be deer-proof, but the deer ate that. And you stop and you pause for 1 second, and you feel the vibration of that symbol. Joy is within you, because that's why Ananda exists. And so we see that Swami created this community, and it's very interesting, because sometimes people go to visit other communities and they say, oh, wow, well, they do this so much better than we do, or they do that so much better than we do. Swami has said that his books are like the spoke of a wheel, and then lots of hubs go out. So the central thought, and then he wrote all sorts of different books. Well, Ananda Village is like the central hub of the community's movement. And from that, we have tried to do everything. We have tried to create model schools. We have tried to create supportive governments led by supportive leadership. We have tried to create enlightened business based on cooperation and creativity. We have tried to create self-sustaining food production. We've tried to create a model family life and relationships at which God is the basis of it all. We have tried to create a way of spreading this message out to the world through all of our ministries, through the Expanding Light, through our website, through healing prayer ministry, all the things that we do, I could list many, many. Our meditation groups, our Kriya ministry, on and on and on, all the wonderful classes that are evolving. And so not only are we living it and modeling it, but we're trying actively to spread it and get it out there. And so we are like the hub of the community's movement. And not to forget the creative arts. All of these things our teachers will be talking about this afternoon. Education and leadership and the arts and all of them. And what's the one? Family life. Thank you, Anandi. You know, I'm just going to take a little pause. Anandi and I have the great joy, whenever there's a major event, to help work on the schedule. And it's so beautiful because, you know, we've both been here at Ananda since the beginning. We both have been trying our best to be devotees and meditating. And we think, oh, my God, SRW. And then we come together. Happens every single time. Within about an hour, we have this whole schedule outline, and it's the fruit of people being in attunement with each other and trying to discover what's trying to happen, not what do I want, what do I think is important, but just that flow of grace. It's such a joy to work in this way. So all these things, Ananda is modeling them in different ways. And Swami has said into the future that there will be communities based entirely on the arts, entirely on education, entirely on healing, and on and on and on. So we're just sort of, one might say, the stem cell from which all of it will come out, all these different expressions. And we need to find ways to invigorate all these aspects of them. It's just beginning. It's really just beginning. And I want to do a little, let's see, where is this? Here it is. I want to do a visualization with you. So I want you all to close your eyes. And I want you all, this is a visualization for the future. This is from Swamiji's Cities of Light, which was written, we'll talk about that later. But close your eyes and bring your gaze to the point between the eyebrow. We've been traveling through time. Now we want to project forward into the future. So use your powers of visualization as I read these words. Try to see very, very clearly every image, every concept. Cities of tomorrow. Imagine a city, a beautiful city, such as a city of tomorrow ought to be. Imagine small residential areas within the city, each surrounded by beautiful parkland for its residents' enjoyment. Imagine homes joyfully designed according to their residents' needs, their outlook on life, their tastes, the way they relate to the land around them. Imagine each home, therefore, a conscious home. Imagine beautiful, expansive vistas wherever you feast your eyes, distant hills and valleys, nearby meadows, trees, and flowers. Imagine a city in which the residents really have a say in determining its shape, its growth, its overall philosophy, development, and design. Imagine farm and dairy land, not struggling for lonely, competitive survival, but ownership of them shared by all and a vital part of the life of everyone. Imagine a community of people who know how to cooperate joyfully together with kindness in their hearts for one another and for all those whom their lives touch. Imagine a community where the leadership is supportive, not bossy, where the emphasis in leadership is on serving, not ruling. Imagine a city where, when someone needs help, everyone freely and lovingly joins in helping him. Imagine a city where human values are given first importance and where the desire for joy and harmony and love are looked upon as needs every bit as practical as material consideration. Imagine a city with schools that teach children the art of living along with the standard offerings of academia. Schools that teach them the meaning of success in human and not merely in economic terms. Schools that teach them how to attract success, how to concentrate, how to overcome their negative moods, and how to get along with others. Imagine a place where people live to find joy and inspiration, and where they want to share their inspiration with others. A place where getting ahead in life is understood in terms of inner self-development. Imagine a life based on a search for inner crystal clarity of mind and heart, a place where people seek to express that clarity in their work, in their home environment, in the arts, in home building, in teaching, in their lives and relationships. Imagine a city of light. Here the light sought is not material merely, but is sought first in terms of expanded awareness and understanding. Imagine a place where people's hearts are simple, without selfish motive, where the residents sincerely love truth and God and strive to see God equally in all mankind. Now open your eyes and look around you. This was written in 1987 for Ananda's 20th anniversary. And in these nearly 25 years that have passed since then, this has emerged more and more beautifully. But we have to keep, this is the goal. We have to keep striving for this goal. Where does it spring from? It springs from the love of God and the love of divine light. And then all of this, all of it, is just an expression of that. The future, let's move forward now. We've come from the past. At a colony leaders meeting we had with Swami earlier this year, he talked about he really wants us to begin working on getting this community's movement out through outreach, through classes, through programs, however we can do it. And so we're starting to put our mind to that. We're creating a new foundation called Foundation for a New Tomorrow. And this will be a way of helping us to put under an umbrella all the aspects of our community that are, one might say, the non-religious. So education, the arts, sharing nature, all of these things, and to really get the word out about these. This is just the beginning. We always need to keep our eye not on the past, but on the goal. This is true of our spiritual life. It's true of our work in the community. It's true of our relationships. It's true of everything we do. Just keep moving forward. God has given us the vision. Master has given us the blueprint. Swami has given us the marching orders. And here we are. And on this anniversary, I think it's really important that we come together and talk about what we've done, why we've done it, and what we want to accomplish in the future, and then to celebrate the great gift that God has given us in allowing us to be part of this great World Brotherhood Community movement that was brought to the earth at this time to change an entire civilization. God bless you.